K-Mud Podcast presents.
Welcome to Mindful Mud. I'm Florina Nickley, your host. I'm a Zen teacher and mindfulness instructor. And this show is about all kinds of ways of how to bring more mindfulness into your daily life, how to bring more purpose into your life. And just mindfulness is such a huge topic. And I'm trying to have different kinds of guests on and talk about different topics just to kind of show the wide range that these practices can offer. Today, I'm very fortunate. I have a special guest from the community here with me in the studio. Welcome, Shaku Daiko. Daiko is the head priest of Daishuin West up in the Benbo Zen Temple. And do you want to just introduce yourself, Daiko? Thank you for being here.
Sure. Thank you for having me, Florina. Yes, I'm the head priest up at Daishuin West. It's a small Zen temple, Rinzai Zen temple, if you're familiar with the different flavors of Zen. That is above Benbo, up East Blue Rock Road, 15 or 20 minutes, if you're familiar with the area. The temple's been there for 30 years now, but it's always surprising how many people in the community are not, in fact, aware that we're up there. So it's nice to be here. Center of the community on the radio and talking to you.
Yeah, this is very special. It's true. There's still a lot of folks who had no idea that this temple is up there. So it's close, right in the middle of the community.
It's a constant refrain. I hear it, meeting people all the time. I've lived in the Southern Humboldt for 50 years and I had no idea you guys were up there. Or maybe I was there one time and I forgot about that place up there.
It's true, yeah.
Nice to be here.
Well, it's not like a radio station where it's everywhere, right?
It's true. There's no real good way to it's not any place you're on the way to anywhere else, for example, likely to drive.
It's not a bar where you stop in.
No. But we do get people, community people, some, through word of mouth. Word of mouth, of course, is the best way.
Right. It's true. Yeah. I mean, yeah. It's a beautiful place up there for sure. You said it's seen 30 years?
30 years. They built, that is, the previous Osho-san, the previous priest there, and Ursula, they built the Hondo, the Buddha Hall, in 1994, 95. So, yes, just 30 years.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of curious if you could let our listeners know what brought you to Zen, what brought you to this path.
Okay. Ooh. Well, the short version is just that I, from a fairly young age, was interested in why people believe things. Why do people believe this over that? It doesn't take long, looking out and investigating the world as one does when you're, we start to become a teenager and think about the wider society. Why do people believe particular things and don't believe other things? A lot of that seems to be based on set and setting, upbringing, and not necessarily fixed in anything that we could call real. So seeing, beliefs and ideas as just kind of arbitrary projections of a person's concept of themselves or the world, that seemed rather insufficient to me. That did not seem satisfying. And so I sort of always had it in the back of my mind, if all of this is really just sort of arbitrary and subjective, beliefs, ideas about oneself and about the world in a greater sense. If that is just subjective, then is there anything that we could really call real? Being a, I would say not maybe perhaps a question authority type of a young person where I'm just like, well, I'm not going to believe what it is that you say I should believe. And so I'm just going to think about what belief is and, you know, come up with my own ideas about it, which, you know, when you recognize that those are also subjective and relative, then you're like, well, is there any solid place that I can put a foot down? And investigated into that. And that just sort of drew me into comparative religion and the religious experience and what people, you know, how different ways people have answered that question throughout time. And but over and over again, I kept coming back to Zen, particularly Rinzai Zen. And that just kind of kept coming up for me. You know, I would read Daisetsu Suzuki or, you know, Philip Kaplow or Shunyu Suzuki, you know, the Zen mind, beginner's mind guy. And I would just be like, yeah, I think this is kind of, I read lots of other stuff too. And I was just always like, yeah, this really seems right on to me. And then in, you know, fast forward, but of course, you know, being a young person, there's plenty of things to be distracted by and other exciting things to do. And so I was just sort of in the back burner, you know, for most of my young life until, you know, fast forward to 2006, I believe, when I came to live with my Aunt Mary and Julie on their property on Blue Slide Road. And then about that time, Aunt Barbara Penny and Christy were lending me Thich Nhat Hanh books, you know, they were really interested in feeding this interest that I had, you know, which, you know, they were into it, so I could talk to them about it. And so they were very encouraging and gave me lots to read. And I appreciated that. And I just kept coming back to it and coming back to it. And of course I had some free time, you know, being out here and being a young person, you know, that I could work and have my morning to light my candle and ring my little bell and do zazen, do sitting meditation for you know, an hour or two before I had my coffee and went about my day, which when you're living a sort of a subsistence life as a student or, you know, young adult somewhere, you rarely have that luxury, or it requires, you know, a lot of effort to really protect that time in the morning, or, you know, whenever you do it. My way to do it was in the morning. And so from there, I was able to, you know, I just kept coming back to the Zen thing, and I remember asking Christy about it, and Christy, you know, I said, like, you know, these books are great, you know, but I'm really resonating with this Zen stuff, and Christy being like, oh yeah, I know there's a Zen temple out there in Benbo somewhere, you know?
So it was kind of for you, like for a lot of people in the community.
Exactly, it's exactly the same. There's yeah. Like, oh yeah, there's this place out there. I know we went there once. But I don't really remember. It was a long time ago. But we know Marilyn Foote, you know, who goes, you know, who's been a longtime supporter of ours. And so Barbara, you know, Beep introduced me to Marilyn, and Marilyn took me to the temple for the first time. And I walked into it, and all of that sort of reading I had done, all of that stuff that I had been exposed to, suddenly just sort of materialized in a concrete way right in front of me. And I was just like, this is what they're talking about. You know, this is the expression of it. Like, this is the real thing. Like, all that theoretical stuff, those ideas and things that I'd read about were suddenly there.
Was it kind of like a coming home?
It was. I consider myself fortunate that there have been a few times in my life, you know, a handful, two or three times in my life, where I've just had that feeling of yes. Like just full being like, this is it, you know, this is what I'm going to do. Like, there isn't even a question. Like, there's not
correct.
Any sort of mental process. Well, there will be mental processes about it, but you know, it's just, you're just like, okay, like this is it, you know,
this is it.
I know this, or however you want to express it. It's to me, it was just like a full body. Yes. You know,
it's very interesting. I had the same feeling when I first arrived at my master's center, mm-hmm. where I'm like, oh, I was already here. Like, yeah, that feeling of like, oh, yeah, that's it.
Yeah. And that was, you know, that was it for me. And then you don't, you know, what are you going to do except, you know, figure out how to be there? You know, I just started coming as much as they would allow me to come. Mm-hmm. And they sort of kept me at an arm's length for a little while. You know, the master does this thing where they're like, oh, you think you're interested, but we'll see how interested you really are. And they sort of put the brakes on you. You know, they say, well, you can only come, you know, you can only come this day and that day and only for, you know, this amount of time. And then, you know, I don't want to see or hear from you again until next week or next month or whatever. And I was just like, okay, you know, just sort of like a little puppy dog, maybe, you know, just like, okay, I'm really, really want to be here some more, you know, okay, I'll come back next week. And just kept coming and kept coming and kept coming until Daijiro Osho, the former priest, it wasn't very long. I think it was just maybe 2 months. So they didn't keep me at an arm's length for that long. I think it was after 2 months or so, he said, okay, well, if you're really that interested, then you should probably just go to Japan and do what I did. Because he had told the story of him going to Japan, and he trained in Japan for 15, 17 years. And that was another, or maybe a continuation of that moment where I was just like, yes, you know, that's it for me. You know, I'm going to go to Japan and do that.
So that was that fast for you, like literally a few months, and then you left to Japan.
Exactly. I came in the summertime, late summertime, to Daishin West for the first time, and I left for Japan. I was in Japan in January. It was really...
That was it. Then how long were you staying in Japan?
I was there for not quite 10 years, nine and a half years. Mm-hmm. Well, it was 7 years. I came back after 7 years for a visit, but I was there for a solid 7 years before I even left the country again.
Oh, wow.
And then I had some visa problems, and I had to kind of fly around and do some things.
Uh-huh.
And it was difficult. But I did get a good solid block of time just living in a traditional temple, you know, just going to the monastery. And I did get a good, you know, I've been back now for 7 years, and sort of looking back at that time period, you know, I think I got, during that time, at least I got a good foundation built. You know, it's just...
For sure.
It's not anything. It's just... You know, what I personally had to go through on the path. Everybody has their own, due to their own unknowable karmic situation. We all have our own, whatever resonates with us. And that was just what resonated with me. And it did enable me to get a good foundation of what we actually do at Daishin West.
Because right.
What we do there is a very traditional Japanese style practice. Daijo and Ursuline coming back from Japan themselves and building the temple 30 years ago. MO, their mode of operation, was to just change as little as possible from what they had learned in Japan themselves, from their teacher, Amori Nagasoka Roshi, who's kind of my Dharma grandfather, and the person responsible for the temple being there is Daijo and Ursula's teacher. And so they took what he taught to them, and they just changed as little as possible.
Mm-hmm.
So we're just going to continue doing this the way we learned it, and that's what they wanted to do. And so I was able to get kind of a good foundation of what that practice looks like before I came back. And fortunately, you know, I'm doing my best to execute that.
I bet you are.
You know, Japan is wonderful and terrible and all the things all at once. I was the only foreigner in a group of 20. Well, at the beginning, when I entered the monastery, it's, you know, 25 other monks. So it's a very unique experience to be the only foreigner. There's been a lot written about foreigners living in Japanese groups, and on top of that, to be a foreigner living in a very traditional Japanese way. In a place like a Zen monastery, when there are certain Japanese cultural institutions, shall we say, that change very, very slowly. And temples are definitely up there. You know, you're still living in the 19th century, basically, in one of these places. Everything is done the way it was done in the 19th century. If we change things here at Daishin West as little as possible, when Daijo and Ursula came back, they haven't changed anything at one of these places for 150 years. That's not entirely true, but you get the point.
Mm-hmm.
You still go out begging almost every morning unless the teacher is giving a talk the Roshi, the Shidosha, like the teacher who you have an interview with twice a day, the mornings and the evenings. You only get as a beginning monk, you only get 3 or 4 hours of sleep a night. You're treated like dirt. You have to do all the terrible jobs. And everybody's mean to you for the first year. And then after that, maybe somebody will talk to you and ask you some questions, you know, and you get a little bit of human fellowship.
So it's real old style.
It's real old style. And it's not unique to being a monk. Of course, this is a Japanese thing. If you're a Japanese carpenter's apprentice, like, you only sweep up wood shavings for the first year. And everybody's mean to you, and you have to do all the terrible jobs. It's how it is. And for me, I think there was a strong reason to go and do something like that. Like, I had part of my feeling. I was speaking about sort of a sense of. I think part of the reason why I wanted to go, and what I wanted to do, had to do with a certain sense of dissatisfaction. Like, I was speaking about looking out at the world and seeing all these different belief systems set up and feeling like they were just subjective and depending on culture and circumstance, and finding that as dissatisfactory, shall we say. But I think I also had a certain amount of personal dissatisfaction where I hadn't made an effort. I had never been really challenged. I sort of squeaked through school, sort of squeaked through life just being a white, straight male in Boulder, Colorado. You know, what do you have to complain about exactly? You don't really have to do much but graduate high school and manage to get into a college, which I did not do because I was like, well, what's more relative value stuff? You know, why would I get involved in that? And so I never really felt like I had been challenged or made to examine. You know, I had never been pushed to my limit or investigated, you know, who I was myself. And I think there's many reasons to go to the monastery. And one reason, you know, one purpose that fulfilled for me was, you know, when you have to go into the situation and you're on the bottom of an extremely strict hierarchical structure and you have to do all these things, you know, and you have no choice. You know, you have absolutely zero choice. You either do the things that are asked of you, or you quit and you go and you do something completely else. There is no, like, I will take this part, but I'm not going to take that other part. Like, this works for me, but like that other stuff, yeah, I'm going to leave that. Thank you very much. You can't do that. You either swallow the whole thing completely or you quit. And there's a lot of wisdom just in that. You know, a lot, life doesn't mind, you know, what – it's not interested in what your ideas about things are and whether it works for you, you know, whether – oh, is this, you know, is this set of circumstances and events, is that okay with you? It doesn't ask, you know, like, you get handed it and you can either sort of try to get away from it or you can just swallow it whole completely. And so you get a lot of practice as that. You know, that's sort of the first thing you learn is like, okay, well, here's all these things that you might have to execute, you know, these circumstances that you have to step up and meet. And you have no choice. You either just do it or not. And I didn't have a big problem with that, actually. I was pretty good at that part. I didn't like it. You know, I complained. I had a buddy. Fortunately, I had my one buddy, my Japanese buddy, Tetsu-san. And he was with me through the whole time. And that guy got an earful. You know, just a poor guy. You know, we're barely on speaking terms now because of all the things that I put him through. Just always asking, why do Japanese people do this? You know, why do we do that? Like, this is this 150-year-old way of doing things. Like, this is absurd. Like, why? You know.
So you've questioned it.
Oh yeah, absolutely questioned. I never went through like a I'm going to quit sort of a thing, but I was just
like why?
This dumb thing that we have to do all the time. Like, what? What is this? And I mean, he got to hear all of that. And then, you know, it actually turns out kind of funny because he, you know, he went back to his temple and he changed a bunch of things and is doing a lot of kind of very new kind of weird stuff from my point of view. And I came back to America where you, in theory, you're supposed to be doing a whole bunch of kind of different and weird stuff from a Japanese perspective. And instead, like, I'm doing, you know, I'm just continuing this traditional practice that I inherited. And he's doing like these tours and, you know, art shows and stuff, you know. So it's funny how things work out sometimes.
It sure is. Okay. And then you stuck it out and...
Right. I stuck it out until I lost my visa. That's what happened there.
All right.
Is that, you know, after a while, they just look at you, and that's the immigration department or whatever they are there. And they say, well, so what are you doing here in Japan? Because you have for this sort of activity, you get a cultural visa. You're studying a Japanese cultural art or something like that. And after a long enough time, they start getting a little antsy. And they're like, so when do you graduate? You know, when do you finish? And when you
– So there is no Dharma visa?
There's no Dharma visa.
There you have really to change isn't. That.
And it's very strange. You would think that they would be, you know, excited about people coming to do this sort of thing. But they don't care. You know, they just want – like if you're studying tea ceremony or something, they say, okay, well, when do you graduate? When do you get your certificate that you've accomplished this program? When you're a Zen monk, they're like, well, what's the curriculum? You know, and you can explain, you know, and we, of course, did. My teacher produced all these documents, you know, that explained about what the Zen curriculum is like. But it doesn't have a definitive ending. And so after a while, the immigration department is just like, yeah, well, okay, 7 years is good enough. Goodbye. And we managed to fudge a few more years there.
Okay, interesting. Yeah, and the changes, right? There's a lot of that in the Zen tradition. How much do we keep the old alive, and how much do we adjust to what's going on now?
Right.
And I mean, this is very interesting to hear kind of that process, right? And I think each temple or each center kind of does their own negotiation with that.
Right. Absolutely.
For sure. Yeah. That's very interesting. You have something in your mind. I did.
I just what we were saying about how every center goes through their own adjustment, you know, this negotiation of – well, there's the question of lineage. Every center, in my opinion, and I've become sort of a traditionalist in this particular way, there's a lineage, and there should be. Like some people might be inspired or, you know, they sort of their own volition, like without making contact. Like I expressed like how I made contact with a lineage, and that was sort of what I came to understand, that there was actually this lineage, that it was real. It wasn't just something in a book, and that I could actually participate in that. And had the opportunity to do so. And as one of our Sangha members said to me, you know, I had no girlfriend, I had no job, I had no debt. You know, I was in a very, very good position to do that. So, you know, when you make contact with a lineage, that's a very, very fortunate thing. And then when you're in a position where, okay, you're doing a center, you know, or in our case, a temple, somewhere else, you know, you in theory you study with that lineage for some amount of time, and then you're doing it yourself, because the best way to learn something is to start teaching it. And this negotiation with, well, what, you know, how do I do it here? Like there are different circumstances. You know, what do I change? It's a very, very complicated thing, and I've fiddled with certain things, you know, because we can't help but fiddle. People, I mean, and myself
yes.
In specific, you know, we can't help but fiddle with things and get involved. But in essentially every single case, you know, I found that my fiddling did not in fact improve the situation, you know, that the way that things were passed down, the way that things were done were, you know, they have their trade-offs like everything else. They're not perfect ways, you know, and the Japanese system certainly isn't perfect. But what are you replacing it with? You know, you have to be very, very sure that what you're replacing with it is actually a net benefit, you know, in some way for people. It's going to have its own trade-offs like everything else. And are you sure you're making better trade-offs than, you know, the tradition that was passed down to you? It's – and in my experience, I'm just like, oh, I might kind of change something for 6 months. And then at the end of 6 months, I'm like, yeah, this is – well, it was a mistake. I should just go back and do it the other way. And then the people that were coming during that six-month period, they're like, why did you change something? And it's like, well, actually, I went back to the way it was done. You know, it wasn't always that way. And if nothing else, like there has to be this consistency so that people – I mean there are a thousand different places that people who have a karmic affinity with the Dharma can go. And the reason why they end up one place or another is because they have some particular karmic affinity with that lineage, with that path, with that way of doing things. And if there isn't that steady, like if they're not clear like what the way of doing things actually is, then there's nothing really for them to grab a hold of. They, you know, you want the student to commit to what the lineage is, to what the procedure is, 100%. You know, like I was able – because of that feeling I talked about earlier where I really knew that this is what it was for me, I was able to throw myself into that 100%. But it's not, you know, it's not so easy.
Yeah, I like that you bring that up because it's like for me it was always there's so much structure and in a way so much in a way rigidity almost when it comes to a certain day in a Zen traditional life. And that exact structure can give you so much freedom.
Right.
And that's, I kind of hear that from you, right? It's like, let's not change the structure that can be such a support in the practice and in life itself.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's really important. And I when you kind of described, you know, that first coming there and like, I'm trying to get away from it, or, you know, the whole idea we're always trying to get away from the uncomfortable, right? And then in a situation like that, you just can't. I mean, you can quit, but you don't want to. and that idea of, I mean, when we look at life, everything is designed to get away from the uncomfortable, and it never works.
Right.
But humans try really hard
right.
to do that. Like with anything and advertisement and salespeople, that's what they're telling you. I can fix you being uncomfortable, and obviously it's not working.
Right.
And in a practice path like that, we're like, okay, it's uncomfortable. Let's see if I can be with it. And yeah, it just kind of made me smile a little there. It's like you can't get away from it. And therefore, you start realizing, oh, that's actually okay.
Yeah.
There's a deep okayness with that.
Right.
Don't need to like it, but there's life right there.
Yeah, exactly. The one of the stories.
Go ahead.
One of the stories I love to tell is about being the cook at the monastery, cooking for these 25 people, and it's the hardest.
That wasn't your first year.
It was second half of my first year.
Oh wow!
Yeah.
You graduated fast.
Well, they just throw you in. It's okay. Just the thing. It's just like, okay, well, here you go. Figure it out and fast, because when the food sucks, everybody's mad. And when you're a foreigner that, you know, doesn't know Japanese food, there's additional complications. But, you know, it's just exhausting and exhausting and exhausting. You're not sleeping, you know, and you have all this pressure, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I was, you know, I got to a point where I didn't think about quitting, but I was just at the end of my rope physically and just completely depressed. You know, I couldn't do anything right. It was terrible. You know, it was, you know, not one of the hardest things that I've ever had to go through. And you're just a complete failure in a group of people, you know, and you can't do anything right. Everybody knows it. Everybody sort of wants to help you or beat you up or something, you know, like they all have an attitude about it, so one way or another, and you're just a problem, you know, you're just a problem, and you have to just sit there and be a problem and try and figure it out. And I just got to this point where it's just like I gave up, you know, in a very freeing way. I was just like, well, okay, I am a complete screw up, you know, I can't do anything right, and that's what it is, and so what am I going to do about that? And I was just like, well, I'm just going to keep trying to do my job the best I can, and it doesn't really matter how I feel about it. And that's the thing. That's, you know, it's a very profound lesson. Life is not personal. Like, it is not about you as a person in your personal way. You know, it is not about how you feel about it. Like, that's what's going on right now. And what are you going to do about it? You can feel all the different things. There's certainly nothing wrong with that. And we will feel all the different things.
It
happens anyway. And, you know, that's wonderful and terrible and all the different things itself. But there's no – it's not the center of the show. You know, it's not the star of the show is how, you know, we might feel about it, you know, the circumstances.
KMUD is a community radio station in the Redwood region of Northern California. Donate to support people-powered radio at kmud.org.
You said at the very beginning you were interested why people believe. And that's a belief itself, right? That whole belief in our own story, the whole belief in, oh, I can't be a failure. I need to be a certain person. I need to be a certain way. That's a belief itself. And that's this real experience of it, as you describe, of like, well, perhaps I am a failure right now. As if I cook, you know, somewhere in Japan, it's just, I'm going to own it. I'm just going to be with that and see what happens.
Right.
That radical openness, right, to life as it is, has been really, for me, where the freedom is at. Yeah, so do you want to talk a little bit more about when you said, also the very much the beginning, of the different flavors of Zen, right? So we talk about Rinzai Zen. Do you want to give the listeners a little bit an idea?
Sure, I can say what I know, but maybe it's obvious from my story. I actually haven't been a lot of different places. I really just walked right into Daishuin West, and now I've been doing this particular lineage, you know, this particular flavor of Zen sense. But generally, you know, there's when we say Zen Buddhism, well, of course, Buddhism is vast. You know, it's just huge, and it's practiced all the different ways. And not unlike, I imagine, how Christianity is practiced. And Zen Buddhism usually refers to, at least in the traditional usage of the word, just refers to this growth that came out through China, you know, from India, through China to Japan, this you know, Chan movement, which is just direct seeing. You know, sometimes Zen people get all hoity-toity and they call it the Buddha Heart School, because it's just the Buddha heart, you know, directly transmitted from the Buddha, like the famous, you know, if people know about the flower sermon when the Buddha just stood up in front of everybody and they're waiting for him to talk and he just held up the flower. And, you know, nobody gets it. Everybody's just like, what? And then, you know, Mahakasyapa is like, you know, smiles. And the Buddha's like, aha, like, you got it. And he says, you know, you got it. I mean, he put it in a much more flowery way than that, but he's like, you know, the unknowable Dharma, you know, here I now pass on to Mahakasyapa. And then he passed it on to Ananda and on and on and on and on and on. Like, there's this ideal, perhaps, or this I don't want to say mythology necessary, but there's this idea. You know, since we're talking about the relevance or the relative value of ideas, that the understanding that Shakyamuni Buddha had under the tree is something that was passed on and is directly knowable to us right now. And all that is required is that you, for yourself, go and look. You don't have to do anything else. You don't have to pray to anybody. You don't have to expurge your past sins, nothing. You know, you have to go and look directly into what you really are. And that's all. I would say that's the hallmark, you know, that's the fundamental idea of the Zen school is you have to know. And when you say like, okay, well, what do you have to know exactly? The way I'm putting it right now, we could say know the Buddha Dharma. We could say know your true self. No reality. You could even say no God if you're inclined to that, but I don't because it's a loaded word for a lot of people. Another way of putting it is just each of us, you know, has the feeling that there is something going on here. Like we know that we are. Like as far as anybody can say, we can say, I am. I know that I am. Beyond that, everything's pretty murky and unknowable. Like we've got these, you know, feelings, there's form out there. We've got these senses that sort of detect things but not really all that accurately a lot of the time. Our emotions are all over the place all the time. Our thoughts are all over the place all the time. You know, it's all really pretty embarrassingly a random, you know, not completely random, but we have this brain, you know, that detects patterns and we're just sort of like, what is actually going on out here? And nobody, we don't know. Like, and that's where this freedom comes in. You know, I don't know. I don't know what this is, you know, but I'm just going to do my best.
Right.
And, but the looking, you know, the turning the light back around and not looking at, you know, outside in the world and being like, okay, what am I? You know, who is asking this question? You know, who is experiencing these things that come up and are apparently experienced somewhere? Like, where exactly are those experienced? I don't actually know where those are experienced. Or by who, you know, and looking into these questions seems to be a reliable way of directing the attention, you know, the light of consciousness towards a satisfactory answer, I would say. And it's that can be known, and through one's own effort, be known is, I would say, the hallmark of this Buddha heart school, which came through China to Japan. And of course, it's not really unique to Zen, but of course, the word Zen has been sort of co-opted and used in a lot of different contexts.
Oh, darn yes.
So it's
sometimes I'm just okay.
It's very confusing.
Very confusing. It's actually the first time when I came to this country and I heard, oh, we're just going to be all Zen. I'm like, what does that mean?
What does that even mean?
I described it like, yeah, in Europe you wouldn't say that.
Yeah.
Perhaps now you would. But
and they think, you know, people – I mean, we get people to come to the temple who, you know, they hear Zen and they think it's going to be some like really, really mellow, relaxed experience. And you know, we have a certain schedule, shall we say. You know, we have a certain.
Yeah, why don't you talk a little bit about your schedule?
Okay,
up
okay.
At the, even though we haven't really touched into Rain's Eye, but that's okay. Let's just go with
right.
The schedule of.
Well, we can segue. It's a good way to segue into the actual Rin's Eye.
Yeah.
Rin's Eye generally, the Zen school or the Rin's Eye school in Japan. Rin's Eye is actually a Chinese gentleman, you know, from the Tang Dynasty. But he is considered the great 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 grandfather of this particular school, and it's just sort of marked by kind of a martial, you know, very strict tone, as opposed to Soto Zen, which tends to be, you know, a little bit more rounder and easygoing. You know, is the from what I hear. I've been to a couple Soto temples just to help out while I was in Japan, but I've never been to a training hall. And from what I hear, the training hall at Eiji is brutal. I'm sure there's a wide range, you know, no matter where you go.
I would say that, yes, depending of the lineage of the teacher of, yeah.
Yeah, it's like the Dalai Lama seems to be a really nice guy, but when you're his disciple, I really doubt he's that, you know, smiley and nice, you know, just a guess based on on my experience with
all right. So when are you like start practicing? When you're waking up?
I speak about changing things. The only change that I've actually kept is I wake up and I do yoga. And that's, we start off with that first thing because it works best for our schedule. But I do an hour and a half of yoga, starting at 4 o'clock in the morning. And then we have the sutras, the traditional reading of the Japanese sutras in the Hondo, after that's done, usually at 5:15.
Can you explain what the Hondo is?
The Hondo is the Buddha hall. That's where the altar is. In a traditional Japanese altar, there's actually sort of a 3-in-1 kind of a situation where you have a central main altar for the Buddha, and then off to each side you'll have like minor, secondary, tertiary altars for sometimes like Rinzai, Bodhidharma, some of the famous old masters, or sometimes more contemporary masters who have died, and then the other side will be lay people associated with the temple who have died, and it'll be a little memorial plaques in there for them, so that they're always there. You have a daily sort of recognition of them. And then in the sutras that I read, after each sutra, there will be a echo, a dedication, I guess you call it, where you kind of shout out these old teachers. You know, you shout out these lay people who have been associated with the temple, and it's, you know, it's, and you read the entire lineage back from Shakyamuni Buddha to my teacher's teacher, to Ursula's teacher, Morinaga Soka Roshi. So there's a, you know, there's a daily sort of taking out the furniture, right, is how Morinaga Soka Roshi famously put it, apparently. You know, you get up in the morning and the first thing is you kind of clean house, you know, you clear out your heart, you know, and you recognize that you're extremely fortunate to be alive and be able to do this, and you recognize the efforts of everything that, which is ultimately like everything in the entire universe. But okay, we don't have all the time in the world, so we'll start with
the lineage,
you know, the Buddha and, you know, the teachers, you know, my teacher who made it possible for me to be here, and her teacher that, you know, made it possible for her to be here, and you know, recognize all that first thing, and the, you know, yeah. Well, it's not the first thing because I do the yoga first,
right.
But mm-hmm. It's right up there. And then breakfast. Well, then they're sitting and somebody has to go cook breakfast if I have somebody else there. You know, we do an hour of sitting, and then somebody will remove themselves partway through and go and cook the rice borers that we have for breakfast. And then cleaning. Lots of cleaning. Anybody who's been to the temple knows that we have lots of pea gravel, and the pea gravel must be cleaned every day, and there are lots of fallen leaves. So that's a major activity of ours.
So Japanese garden style.
Yes. We don't do any fancy gravel patterns or anything like that, which actually makes it more difficult. But lots of picking up leaves and, mm-hmm. and the little katykins and little pine needles and all the things.
All of it.
Yeah. And at a certain point, of course, we'll have lunch at 11:30. It's lunchtime.
So you have that work period in the morning after all the practice and after breakfast, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
And then there's lunch.
And then there will be lunch. And then everybody gets a little bit of a break, an hour break, an hour and a half break, depending on the time of year and what our schedule is like before we meet up again for more work. And hopefully we got all the cleaning and raking done so we can actually move some projects forward. Everybody who you know, has a piece of property in Southern Humboldt knows that there's never any shortage of projects that need to be done. And we're no different. So it's very, very helpful when we have people staying at the temple and there aren't too many falling leaves. And so we can move some of that stuff forward a little bit. But you can't get too excited because at 4 o'clock there will be some tea and you know, crackers and cheese and things, a little evening meal. And then we're back on the cushion at 6 or 6:30, depending on the time of year, for the evening sitting period. And that's really it. You know, you wake up and you have these bookends in the day, you know, in the morning of the sutras and the sitting, and in the evening of sutras and sitting. And then during the day, you know, you're just taking care of what needs to be taken care of. You know, just, it's very, very regular. It's just regular and normal and very, very nice that way.
That is very nice. I've always enjoyed that, staying at, you know, at my center, just that. Oh, I don't have to think about how my day is going to be.
You never have to worry.
I don't have to organize it.
Yeah, what you're going to wear. You know what you're going to wear.
It's, exactly. You know when to go to bed. You know when to get up. You know what to eat. It's like no problems.
And that's what you mean about the freedom. Like it seems very, very rigid. And if you're not used to it, like there's this rigidity to it that some people kind of have friction with. But once you relax into it, it's actually, you know, there's no other good word to describe it than freedom. You know, don't have to, all that administrative overhead is just gone. You know, you just don't have to worry about, somebody else is going to tell me what to do. They're going to cook the food for me. They're going to tell me where to be when. And I just have to examine who I am. You know, I just examine, you know, who is it that's raking this gravel?
Right. You know? Finally time for that.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And you'll try and get it, like you're saying, you try and get away from it. You know, you try and like, you may have come there to do that, you know, but even still, once you get to that moment, then you're trying to kind of get away. You're like, oh, well, I have some very important things to think about. you know. And
well, the brain always thinks it's very important. Yeah. Certain ego patterns, right?
And,
it's like,
and that happens too.
Yeah, you know? Exactly.
And,
all of it.
And
yeah.
You can't get down on yourself for that.
No, it's called being human, right?
Right.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I really enjoy our conversation. That's it's good stuff. I hope our listeners are getting something out of it, but I'm pretty sure. So I would love to open up the phone lines if you do have a question or a comment. Please direct it to Shoku Daiko, the head priest of the Zen Temple in Benbo, who is here with me at the Kmart Studios. And the phone number here is 707-923-3911, and Julian will get your call. Please keep it related to the topic. Anything Zen related should be fine. Thanks, Julian, for and we already got a phone call, I think. That didn't take long.
Somebody was just waiting.
Probably somebody was just waiting. So anyway, I'm curious a little bit, like, how often do you have visitors? If you want to talk a little bit about, like, your offerings at the time.
Thank you. That's very kind of you. Well, as often as we can, really. I have the place open where I'm always there, you know, and I'm always doing the schedule. Like I said earlier, like, you have to – it has to be something consistent that people can come and they know what to expect and can plug into. If it's all over the place and you're changing things and you're like, it's this that day and then something else the next time, then there's nothing that people can connect with. So my aspiration, you know, my goal is just to have people come. And this is what it is. And they have to be doing what it is. You know, that's the only prerequisite.
You can't just come for tea.
Well, you could just come for tea.
But
you
know? Only once.
But yeah. But, you know, after a while of just coming for tea, it's like, well, okay.
What's your purpose here?
Yeah, here's a rake, you know.
Right,
you know,
exactly.
Here's a broom,
totally.
You know?
So, and then you have visitors. Okay, actually, we have two callers. So let's just go and see how that works. Caller, you're on the air.
Hi.
Welcome. Hello.
I just wanted to tell you that I've enjoyed your talk, and it's been like a meditation. The whole talk has been a meditation. I like the way he has presented. I like the way Roshi has presented the story because with humility and not pride. So I have felt like I'm walking beside him. It was also a meditation for life. Life doesn't give you what you want, but that's why we do the practice. That's why we train for it.
That's right.
Although it's interesting and to hear that it's that difficult there at this Soto Zen. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for the call. It's very kind of you. I would discovery is an interesting word because in the end, you know, it's not, you know, you were there all the time, you know, and I had to go through, you know, jump through all these hoops, and I still am, of course. But, you know, it's the practice is always, in my experience, I should say, is always experienced as like a letting go. You know, it's like, it's not that you gained anything that you weren't before, it's that you just stop being so stupid, kind of, you know.
Such a good way of describing it, just stop being stupid.
Just stop making a mistake, you know. And that is a discovery in a way, you know, but it's not like you – but it's different from gaining something, I guess is just what I wanted to say. So, yeah, but thank you for the kind words. I'm glad that, you know, it's being taken that way.
It's a good reminder, right? It's that idea we often go into a path because we want to get somewhere.
Right.
We want to go somewhere. We want to gain something, right? Oh, there's going to be a 10-step program for enlightenment, right?
Right,
that
right.
Kind of deal.
Yeah, yeah.
And I do think, I mean, I can just talk about myself. I started my path definitely like that. Mm-hmm. I'm going to gain the end of suffering. I'm going to gain truth. I'm going to gain all these things.
Yeah, there's a thing called the end of suffering, and I'm going to get it, you know?
Correct. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I'm going to go get it, right? And I'm going to be good at it, too.
Right. Yeah.
So, and obviously, the more you get into it, the more you realize, oh, no, it's not gaining at all. It's just letting go more and more and more and more layers.
Right.
Oh, and there's another one.
I'm still doing that? I thought, wait, what? You know, I was sure that I stopped doing that. But it goes back to what, you know, we were talking about, you know, just a short bit ago, just like originally, like the putting of the I thing, you know, the person thing front and center. Like we just keep doing that over and over and over again. And then we're hurt and upset when it's shown that it's in fact not front and center anywhere except, you know, in our own little self-view, and that we keep trying to do that and it keeps hurting. But when then we say, oh, well, maybe we have a brief moment of clarity. We're like, oh, that's not really how it is and I should really stop doing that. And then next thing you know, we're like, it's so pernicious and subtle. You know, we're just back to doing it, you know, the next moment.
Yeah, it almost becomes more and more subtle. Longer.
You see the deeper layers, you know, you start seeing the deeper layers.
Oh, this stuff is tricky.
Yeah, really.
Like the human mind is endless.
And that's why lineage, you know, I really, I'm, you know, like I said, I've become sort of a traditionalist in this way, and I just keep coming back to lineage because having that person, you know, that when you're doing it again, is like, knock, knock, you know, hey, you know, you're doing it again because it, how do you know from the inside?
Yeah. So before we have another caller, perhaps I'm curious to go back to that question of, so you said you're going to have visitors sometimes. Do you have like visitors for a day or for weeks or?
Well, visitor isn't the right way to put it. I don't like visitors.
Okay.
We don't take visitors.
I'm glad you're reframing that. I'm curious what you're going to say.
Well, see, that's the thing, because coming to the temple, like the only real requirement is that you're on the program. And like I described the program, you know, you're getting up early in the morning and you're doing a particular thing. You have to do it a particular way. You know, you're not just raking the gravel any old way. You know, there's a way that we do it. There's a way that we eat. There's a way that we sit. And I, because I'm the, you know, the person, you know, it's my job to tell people what to do. And a lot of people do not like that very much. You know, they show up and they're like, oh, go to a Zen temple. It's going to be really, really nice and chill and everything. And then I'm like, no, sit up straight. Eat like this. Hurry up. You know, we have this to do next. You know, you have 3 minutes to go to the bathroom and get back and get in on your seat. And that, you know, that can be unappreciated sometimes. And so visitor just puts out sort of the wrong vibe.
Okay.
Because they, you know, we don't. One of the first things that I tend to go through with people is that we do not operate on a pay for service model. I am not providing a service for somebody and taking money in return. Like people can, if they find value in what we're doing, then they are welcome to help support the place through their energy. You know, whether showing up and helping with the raking the gravel or whatever, or financially, or whatever. You know, however they want to, however they're, you know, ever each according to their ability and inclination, right? But they have to be on the program. You know, that's not negotiable. So, I mean, practitioner, you know, they have to aspire anyway to practice and come to the temple and then they can be there. Right now, you know, there's a young man right now in Japan who went there. He stayed all last year, all of 2023, was at the temple. And now he's, you know, training at a temple in Japan to go to the monastery in the fall. And another young lady who just went a few weeks ago, who did, you know, 6 months at Daishun West and is going to train with a Roshi in Japan now. And, you know, we do have people that will come for a weekend, drive up from San Francisco or something and stay for a weekend and do the program, stay through. We have a Sunday morning meditation that I tend to recommend to people if they're coming for the first time because it's well attended. People can show up and, you know, just sit and listen to a short talk, have a cup of tea and leave, and it's very clean.
And that's kind of like an opening also just for regular people in the community.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. If a visitor were to come, that would be the time to come.
To practice with you.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. No, I'm glad you changed that because it can definitely give the wrong vibe.
Yeah. But, you know, and I take people for as long as they're willing to do it, you know, just it's
so it's on an individual basis.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. When people are welcome to come and stay at the temple for as long as they like, provided, you know, that they're on the program and willing to learn how to do it. Because everybody comes in not knowing anything. You know, it's a particular form. It's not uncommon, you know, like I know you do the Qigong and other things as well, but it's not unlike a martial arts form where you just have to learn how to do it. And so the first few hundred days or however long is not as meditative perhaps as you might expect, because you have to learn the form. You have to remember these are the sutras. You know, they're read very quickly in Japanese. This is how we eat. And I have to remember that I have to lay out my bowls this way and the sticks go like this. And I don't want to do that. I can't put that away now. I have to wait for that and the whole thing. So you learn
the whole form.
Process. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And once you do that, then that administrative overhead just goes away and you never have to think about it really ever again. I mean, until you do, but you know, it opens up a whole lot. But you have to start with learning that. So any visitor type person that comes, you know, starts with just the basic how to eat, you know, how to sleep. You know, it's we live, you know, we have all tatami floors in the sleeping areas anyway. We have benches for eating, so people don't have to sit on the floor for eating, but. You know, the ton in the zendo, it's all tatami, and you have to sit with your legs crossed up on the platform. The ton is the meditation platform, right, that you climb up to. And in the hondo, there are no chairs. You know, when we go into the hondo for tea, everybody is sitting on the floor. You know, roll out a futon and sleep on the floor. It's you have to learn how to do these things if you're not used to them. So
right, the practical routines and yeah. Yeah, that is a learning.
It can be a lot.
It can be getting into it. Yeah.
At least it's in English here, not in Japanese.
It's in English. Yeah, that is helpful, isn't it? Yeah. What are some teachings that you feel like are really helpful?
Well, I mean, Daishun West, and I think any really, you know, any Rinzai Zen temple that is the real deal, shall we say. You know, its sole function is to help people or alleged people on their way to recognizing, you know, what they really are, you know, what their true nature is. And, you know, as we were saying earlier, disregarding or recognizing and not taking so seriously perhaps those things that we get distracted with or fiddle with. And everything should be pointed just towards that. And that's why when you start changing things, you know, you start sort of making allowances for different scenarios, you know, for different people. You start, you know, saying, oh, well, this person has a hard time with that, so I'll just kind of make this a little bit easier for them, you know. And it's actually not doing them a favor so much. You know, they're rubbing up against something, and that's where the practice happens. Like the practice is in the friction. You know, anybody can be, you know, happy and healthy and loving and giving when everything's going well. You know, how well do you do when things are bad? You know, when you haven't slept and you're, you know, stinky and hungry and, you know, everybody's mean to you all the time. You know, it's you know, that's when you need to, you know, be shining love, you know, when you need to know like what you really are, which is, we can call that love too. You know, it's not a different way of describing, you know, what we really are, you know, which is, you know, perfect, undifferentiated consciousness that extends everywhere in all directions equally. You know, it is not any different here than it is over there or with any of us. You know, that is, in the end, all there is, and we're just experiencing
this through some lens that we arbitrarily like create and pick up and play with because it's entertaining for a short time.
Okay, I'm going to go radical here.
Yeah, yeah, please. Please. We're taking the leap.
We are. Because this is such a different practicing, right? Than when we now look at, let's just be honest, what a lot of people who are starting to be like, okay, I'm drawn to some kind of meditation or mindfulness or whatever practices those are. And in this day where there's so much technology and so much distraction, a lot of people actually start with apps,
right?
With the Calm app or the Headspace or whatever they are all called. And so it's kind of like a little bit more of a self-help approach.
Right.
And so I'm just kind of curious, right? Because that's going to be completely different because that's going to make it really comfortable in a way, right? What's your thought of that kind of start or that kind of offering that's out there?
Well, I mean, I think it can be a legit start. I can see how people could find an entryway there, but I don't see how it can really, as long as you're comfortable, as long as you're functioning, what's the saying, life begins at the end of your comfort zone.
Yep.
As long as you're just functioning like within that, and there's nothing wrong with that either. But if you really want to get down to brass tacks, and stop sort of coddling yourself along, you have to step out into something unknown. And that's the thing, it all happens on the app and it's all, it's going to be just 15 minutes and then it's going to be over or whatever it is. Like it's very,
very
regular.
There's nice soothing music with it or something.
It's not going to, it could help for various things, but is it going to actually develop into a real who am I sort of practice? Like I don't see it.
Yeah, no, I'm absolutely there with you. I think it can really support a lot of people. And I've also seen people who started to realize, okay, this is my door in, like my foot in somehow, and I'm starting to realizing. And then, yes, if there is curiosity of something deeper, then the real practice starts. Yeah, where, as you said, I think that embracing discomfort is a big one. And with this society where everything has just been taught to, it just needs to feel good.
Right.
What an illusion.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not a good thing. It's not a good thing. And there will be legitimate criticisms where it's like, okay, well, we don't want to self-torment or, people take it, to an opposite extreme too. And that certainly happens. And there are no hard and fast rules actually for determining, distinguishing between, what would we call legitimate practice, and I'm making the little air quotes with my fingers, and, what becomes like just sort of arbitrarily and capricious undergoing of unpleasantness, and there's no hard and fast way, to differentiate between those things. People have to use their best judgment. And that's part of the practice, actually, is
yes.
Like learning discernment about, what is needed and what.
Would you say it's partially individual? Like everybody has to find their own individual sweet spot of how much effort?
I think that comes later.
Okay.
I think that comes, I think that's after you're sort of matured. And then, okay, then maybe you kind of know what you're about. But in the beginning, the first 10 years, yeah, it's better if you just don't have those options,
Interesting.
In my experience,
Yeah,
my way of doing it,
yeah.
It's just like, it's just not and that's actually how it was described to me. It's just, you just put your head down and do this for 10 years, and then think about, and then you can think about it.
So in the way of not giving the ego options
exactly.
to like tweak the practice
right.
kind of thing.
Right. It's too like we're all too kind of unrestrained and we're just not seeing our mistakes. We're constantly making mistakes, but we just haven't learned what they are yet.
And when you start adjusting things, like you inevitably adjust towards self-comfort. You know, you adjust away from the things that are unpleasant and towards self-comfort. So when you're given those options, you'll just sort of inevitably shy away towards something that is kind of protective of the ego self, you know, and you'll just err in that direction. And probably not consciously, but you might have the best of intentions, you know, but you'll just sort of end up going – my experiences, you know, I should speak for myself here. You know, my experience is that I will end up in that going in that direction. And it's just better if I don't have the option. And then maybe, you know, at some point, you know, when, you know, the practice is really established and I know what my mistakes are, then I can clearly, you know, knowing like what the issues are, be like, okay, well, this, you know, I this is okay. You know?
When you noticed your own patterns and, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I mean, for a lot of people, just simply sitting for an hour and a half or something can be very...
Half an hour, you know, 20 minutes, yeah. You know, like it's absolutely, you know, do what you can, you know, there's not... I mean, I sold the farm and went to Japan to be a monk, you know, just like that, which is a really... silly thing to do kind of in retrospect, you know, and it's not it's kind of dumb, you know, honestly, you know, because why do you have to do something so dramatic and weird, you know, like there's no place to go, there's nothing to get, you know, what's your problem? There's a really legitimate argument to be made there.
And at the same time.
And at the same time, that's just, you know, what some people have to do. But not everybody's got their own way with it. So you just have to start where you are.
Right. So what would you say if somebody is interested in starting a practice?
This is where you start to develop discernment. It's like, what exactly are you attracted towards? You know, what do you really feel like is in your own best interest of, you know, spiritual development?
Mm-hmm.
And what practices, you know, seem to resonate with you? And do you know, like, that you're not doing them, you know, when you're not doing them, do you feel like, you know, you're out of accountability with yourself? Because if you feel that way, then you probably are. And maybe you should be a little bit stricter with yourself. You know, on the other hand, you know, if you err towards really severe, like, self-deprecation and self-criticism, then that's not a good way for you. You know, then you need to, you know, something more, you know, supportive and, you know, not thinking too big all at once, you know, and just make slow steps towards that, you know, that thing which seems like a goal. Like we're saying there's no goals, there's nothing to get to, you know, but it isn't necessarily a bad thing to set them up in the interim, you know.
Well, we kind of have to have it.
We kind of have to. Kind of have
to. So we can lose it.
Yeah, we can. So we can constantly be frustrated about why, you know, we're not reaching these goals that I set up. You know, was that just an illusion? Oh, wait, I did it again. Yeah. But yeah, absolutely. Set up goals, you know, just simple, attainable things. I want to get up and, you know, do an hour of yoga and sit for an hour, you know, and that's already a lot. You know, if you can do that, you know, then that's fantastic.
I've seen people starting with 15, 20 minutes in the morning and it's changed a lot.
We have an online sit, you know, at 6:30 in the morning. You know, I started doing it during COVID like everybody else. And it's been, you know, I was very skeptical at first, you know. However, it's been a good thing for these people who are maybe a little further away, but they want to start developing something. And you just have them turn on the camera at 6:30 in the morning and log in, and they're on the cushion for half an hour.
Nice. Tell me more about that offering.
Okay. Yeah, thank you. Not every day. Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. So not Sundays or Mondays, because we have other things going on Sundays and Mondays in the morning. But every Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday at 6:30 in the morning, we have a online sit that anybody's welcome to attend. It's the website is www.daishuinwest.org.
Right. Can you spell that?
Yeah, shall I? daishuinwest.org. And there's a link on the website for the online sit. It says Zazenkai, I believe, which is just
yep.
Sitting group.
Mm-hmm.
Sitting.
Mm-hmm. And that's 6:30 to 7.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, just one period, make it real easy.
And folks can just join in.
Yeah, absolutely.
And would you say they should better lock themselves in 5 minutes early?
Yeah, it's good because several people, you know, have a unfortunate tendency to log in a little late. Even long-time practitioners sometimes log in a little bit late.
How much we love that in Zen.
So, yes, I mean, yeah. Please log in a little bit early and mute your microphone, please, because if everybody has their microphones on, you know, then you get all the street noise and all that stuff, and it's very distracting.
Yeah. Okay, well, that's wonderful.
Thank you for reminding me.
Anything else you would like the listeners know about the temple, about things you're offering?
I think everybody, I mean, regardless of who we are, what our situation is, you know, we're all busy, you know, if not physically busy, you know, we've got a lot going on upstairs. And regardless of anybody's sort of spiritual interest or lack thereof or attitude, you know, we all need some time outside of our own familiar habits. The things that we surround ourselves with that reinforce our concept of ourselves ultimately, you know, and maybe we have bad habits too that we want to change. It doesn't really matter. You know, the original bad habit is just the constant assertion of ourselves as the center of the universe. And all the other bad habits stem from that, because that assertion, you know, just setting ourselves up in opposition to life, you know, as if they were two different things, you know, innately, you know, that just invites some kind of, well, it's actually violent, you know, it is itself violent, you know, it's not accurate. For one thing, we are, the I thing is in no way separate from everything else. It is in no way the center of the universe, but we set it up there, and it's a form of violence where we try and impose that on what is. And that's the original misapprehension, you know, that we're looking to undo. And so if we take ourselves out of our familiar spaces and our daily environment, you know, maybe there's a little crack that opens up, you know, where some other, you know, way of being can slip in. You know, and regardless of anybody's spiritual, whatever other feelings about Buddhism or whatever, it doesn't really matter to me. You know, what I'm interested in is providing an opportunity for that crack to open up, and so people can experience like a different way of being.
Giving a place for that to tune in to that curiosity.
Yeah.
Of whatever that curiosity is.
Yeah.
I'm not sure, Julian, do we have a caller? Okay. We have just time for another caller. Caller, I think you're on the air.
Oh, that was really beautiful, what was just being said. I appreciate being able to hear that. when you were talking about making a decision, and it might have been foolish, but probably now you can perhaps see that it was a good decision, I was wondering about regret, if that is a ego-centered, is that just a human conception, or where does regret come from, and what do we do with it?
Well, that's, yeah. Well, anything that's, you know, anything that can come up will come up, you know, regret included. Like, regret is a thing. But I think, it's good to keep in mind that, I mean, regret is always in contrast to something else, right? It's always in contrast to, like, I wish things were like this other way. You know, I regret this because it would have been better like some other way. Like, there's some sort of conceptual comparison going on there. And that's okay. Yeah. You know, there isn't anything wrong with comparison or, you know, analyzing things. But any way you slice it, like, that's not what's up. You know, that's not what's happening. You know, the things are the way they are. And we can say, oh, we can have the idea, you know, the concept of like, oh, maybe they would be better if they were a different way. But that isn't really any more than just sort of hurting ourselves, you know, just like, you know, dragging ourselves over the coal because of some idea, because we have this idea that things would be better in a different way, you know, which they're not, you know, and they never will be. They are how they are. And so regret comes up with, in contrast to this projection of an idea of something better, right? Is that so? Does that fit with your experience?
Yeah, I appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. I'm going to re-listen to this whole talk. Thank you.
Yeah, of course. So I just say, you know, it's not, you know, it's, there's nothing wrong with it. Like, you don't want to then get you know, upset with yourself for having regret because you shouldn't have regret or something like that. You know, just that's comes up too, you know, and you can't backbite yourself then about this other thing that comes up, because then you're doing it again and you're like, oh, I wish I didn't have regret. You know, I regret having regret, and you get in this whole thing.
And it's the just, wheel.
Yeah.
Back to the seat. Thank you so much.
Yeah, of course.
Isn't that true? Isn't that true? Like, we have a certain idea and then we're punishing ourselves on top of it, and there we go.
Yeah.
It's just a whole turmoil.
Why can't we just leave things alone?
Would that be something you would have the listeners just like, just leave things alone?
That's not a bad final takeaway, honestly. You know, just leave it alone. Just leave it all alone, you know. And you know, notice that there is noticing, and that's enough. You know, that's really enough. And once all the, you know, sort of dross and you know, attachment, the things that arise aren't a problem, you know, it's the latching on to them, yeah, it's the hooking, you know, that things have or that we grab onto, or however you want to phrase it, you know, that causes the problem. Just let things be, you know. And
sounds so easy, and that's where the practice comes
and
in.
Do
right?
What, yeah, it's not inert either, you know, because we always have to do what is needful. You know, there's plenty of things that need to be done. We all want to work for a better world, and there's nothing wrong with that. We do have ideas about what is good and what is bad, and there's nothing wrong with that. And we should all work, you know, to produce the better world that we would like to see. But we can't do that from that place of self-involvement and putting ourselves at the center of the world, because it's that perfectly understandable good desire to improve things will come out twisted, you know, just innately. It'll come out through this lens of myself, and we will end up creating it will not have the results that we would hope.
We create more suffering.
Yeah.
Because we know how it's best.
We know how it's best. And
wow. Thank you so, so much, Daiko. No, that was a wonderful sharing. You're very, very generous.
No, thank you for having me on.
For being here, sharing your presence, sharing your wisdom. You have been tuned in to Mindful Mud on KMUD. This will be the end of the show.
This has been a KMUD podcast. To listen to other shows and more episodes of this show, find us on all the platforms where you get your podcast, and also on our website, kmud.org.